on radio, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is InvestTalk, above average investing for the average investor. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, here's KPP Financial Executive Vice President, Portfolio Manager, Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to InvestTalk. This is our April 13th, 2015 edition of InvestTalk, and I'd like to welcome all of our listeners listening throughout California on our terrestrial stations and those listening online via investtalk.com. And as always, our growing legion of podcast listeners. I feel like we get more and more questions from those listeners each and every week and to the show and to KP Financial, just asking questions as well about how to successfully get to retirement. And that's what we are here to do. We are here to answer as many questions as we possibly can and give you some insight into the market, the economy, and let you understand what is going on, because it is a very complex world, and it's something that for most people can be overwhelming, and that's understandable. It's understandable that in today's day and age, with so many news outlets, so many ways to get information, so many different companies that are out there, asset classes, our globalization of our economy, it's really become a daunting task for a lot of people. And our job here each and every day is to try to simplify it all for you and get down to the nitty-gritty, get down to what's important. Because, you know, there's the old saying of paralysis from analysis, meaning you look at everything and you find out this and you figure out that and you weigh the pros and cons, and then but at the end of the day, it's just too much for you to really handle. And our goal here is to try to decipher what matters, what's important to not only our economy but your portfolio as well. And we always say your questions always come first, and you know you might hear many stock questions, but your general and beginner questions are just as important, just as welcome. We try to answer your questions too with our 24-hour listener line for those that are listening after hours. But you can always talk to us live Monday through Friday, 4 to 5 Pacific time, and we are always here for you. Now, Steve and I are always talking about two emotions that drive movements in the stock market: fear and greed. And with market volatility comes fear. Even small pullbacks are enough these days to get people scared. And trading off of emotion and irrational thinking tends to lead to poor performance. And if you're an investor who can easily be spooked, you may want to reduce the volatility of your overall portfolio. Now, one way to do this is to add ETFs to your portfolio to instantly add diversification and reduce exposure to one particular company or maybe just one particular asset class. You know, we had a high net worth individual send me his portfolio. He's a client. He has other assets, and I'm trying to get him a sense of his whole portfolio. And he has a lot of domestic equity exposure through ETFs and mutual funds, etc. And I said, you know, you need to diversify away from domestic equities, because it's probably one of the worst risk reward areas of the marketplace today. So there's ways that you can rejigger your portfolio to not only catch more upside of the market by finding better values, better growth opportunities, etc., but also to reduce your risk in your portfolio. Now, you can do that in many ways. That's one way, but you can also add certain ETFs that use low volatility companies. There are ETFs that do that. There's the S&P Low Volatility Index, there's a Russell 2000 Low Volatility Index, and these all allow you to have exposure to low volatility stocks. And that can be a way to diversify as well, but that doesn't mean it gets rid of risk completely. It's just lower than typical equities, right? So for less volatile individual stocks, you should concentrate into low beta, large cap companies. Think of big blue chip names, household names that you that everyone's heard of. And remember, if the company does not have quality fundamentals with good potential for long-term appreciation, then you should not own it either way. So it's about understanding, finding the right values with the right growth mix long-term. And as we'll talk about at this Saturday morning wealth conference on the 25th of this month, diversifying outside of domestic markets will reduce your risk, will help you reduce your risk because it further diversifies your portfolio. So we recommend using ETFs to gain some of this exposure, using such as the iShares MSCI Emerging Market ETF. That's just one example of how you can use ETFs to diversify your portfolio, but there's also ways to use individual companies to diversify your portfolio as well. So keeping your portfolio's volatility to the appropriate levels is a great way to increase your odds of making rational decisions instead of ones based on your emotions. Because that happens a lot. People chase. They say, oh, I want to invest in this because it's been doing well or it's doing great or whatever their rationale is behind it. But they don't understand how that affects their portfolio and the risk that they're taking. They need to understand that in context. And if you can say, okay, I think this is a good idea. I think I should add this to my portfolio. And then they look at that and they look at that all of that in context, right, to their entire what their needs are from a risk basis, and it doesn't fit in that in those parameters. Well, then they can kind of step back and maybe think about not investing in that particular position, or maybe taking a smaller position than they would have normally. So it's really about finding that right balance between where you want your portfolio to be and where it really should be based on your needs and risk tolerance. Now remember, you can talk to us live 4 to 5 Pacific time on Invest Talk, or in between times, just leave your question. Here's our first question of the day from our 24-hour listener line. The number is 888-99-CHART. That's 888-992-4278.
Hi, Steve. This is Gilberto from San Mateo. I'm an everyday listener. I'm trying to choose between Nike and UA. Fast Money is recommending UA with the symbols U and A. Because of the growth, but I found out that the PE is 88 times. Please tell me your opinion, or rather tell me when to buy or sell. Thank you.
All right, he's trying to compare and contrast Nike and Under Armour. You know, Nike is the big bellwether of the sports apparel industry. They're a very profitable, strong company. They pay a little bit of a dividend, which is nice, about 1.1%. But they are getting bombarded with competition, you know, from the likes of Under Armour, Adidas, Reebok, etc. Actually, I think Adidas bought Reebok, so I guess they're out of the picture. But you know, Nike is a big blue chip company. It's a $85 billion company. Just a juggernaut, really marketing juggernaut. They make great products. I know me personally, I play a lot of basketball. I played basketball in high school, a little bit in college, and it's the only thing I really wear is Nike, all there from apparel head to toe, really. So I can't say anything bad about Nike, and that's for most basketball players. I mean, I go to the gym and I play basketball with my friends and I don't. It's very rare to see anybody wearing anything but Nike. So, you know, the strength of their brand is. It's hard to overstate how strong that brand is. And now, Under Armour is kind of the up and comer. They do have strong growth. They are very profitable. Modest amount of debt. Their revenue is growing about 30%. Earnings are growing around that level over the last 5 years, whereas Nike, you know, their growth is closer to the low teens, it's low to mid-teens from growth and earnings. So you see the difference in growth rates there. I think it depends on your risk level. I think Nike will be strong and has a much lower risk long term, even though it is on the expensive side. And Under Armour has a lot more growth potential long term because of its lower revenue base, its potential to steal market share from Nike and the other players, and maybe unseat Adidas as number two. They might even be close to doing that. But you know, they don't have nearly the type of brand that Nike does, the type of athletes that sponsor the brand. So it's a much, much higher risk, much more expensive, way more expensive, and you're paying up for that growth. So to me, I would go with Nike because it's cheaper, even though the growth isn't as strong, they're more profitable. And you know, the Under Armour is going to have to maintain this growth for many, many years to come for them to make that P ratio justifiable. And at these levels, I can't see that. So I would be picking Nike over Under Armour. Okay. Now, hedge funds are kind of a double or nothing game. Big returns and high risk. Should you be in a hedge fund, and what are the risks of a hedge fund? We're going to talk about that. It's our main talking point today. But I also have others as well. I also want to talk about the economic numbers coming out this week that are pretty important. And the big reason they're important is because of the weak economic growth projections that our analysts are expecting for the first quarter. Some are expecting a sub 1% GDP growth for the quarter. I don't think any analysts are expecting above a 2% at this point. So you're probably going to see something in the neighborhood of, you know, 0.5% growth on the downside to maybe 1.5-2% max growth from GDP in the first quarter. So a very kind of a subdued growth picture for the first quarter. And you're going to start seeing economic news come out this week to give you a sense of what happened in March, which is obviously the first quarter, but also some news about what's going to happen going forward. And I want to touch on that and what you should look for on that front. Then I want to touch on 401k millionaires. Is it a ridiculous idea? There's a report out from Fidelity that has sparked some pretty big articles on MarketWatch, CNN, USA Today, talking about millionaire 401k accounts. And I want to talk about maybe some misnomers about some of those articles and ways, what things that you need to do to try to assure that you are eventually become one of those 401k millionaires. And then also QE costs. What are the costs of QE? Not just here in America, but worldwide. And is it worth it? There's a new report from Swiss Re, which is an insurance company, and they have a pretty, I don't want to say scathing, but interesting report, and we're going to talk about that. Now, every month, Steve schedules at least one date when he meets with listeners for individual portfolio reviews. These are informal sessions where he looks at your retirement plan documents and offers opinions on and shows you some options on what you can do to make everything better. Where it's very informal. We meet at one of the KP Financial satellite offices in California. You can join up on Skype or even the telephone to reserve your time. At first come, first serve. Just go to investtalk.com, click on the schedule a meeting button.
Annuities, asset allocation, reading stock market trends, building a truly balanced portfolio. If it's important to you and you want to know more about it, we're here for you. 888-99-CHART.
Let's talk quickly about the market for today. The S&P closed down about 9.5 points. That was about 0.5%. The Dow closed down 80. You had the NASDAQ was down about 8. Definitely the stronger of the indexes. Gold was about, it was down a little bit. Oil was up a little bit. You had the dollar stronger, but very modestly stronger. But that was kind of the market today. Really not good news. Everyone's kind of jittery about earnings. You had Alcoa come out last week. They had weak earnings. I think there was JP Morgan after hours. Let's see, what did JP Morgan do after hours? That is up slightly. They had earnings come out, and that was up slightly. What else? Actually, no, I think they might be in the morning. So they're up modestly after hours, but it was really not a good day, to be frank. You see markets trying to get back. The S&P's trying to get back to the highs that we saw at the beginning of March, you know, end of February time frame. You had a lower high in mid-March, and now you're trying to make, you know, a higher high, which is that technically that's what you want to look for, higher highs. Higher lows, higher highs. And if we fail here, you're going to see lower highs, and lower highs usually lead to lower lows as well, and that starts to have a deteriorating technical picture. And so I think we're at a critical time for the market, and there's going to be a lot of economic news that come out this week, and I think that'll give us a good indication of where the market is headed and thus where the economy is headed. Now remember, you can save $10 off the price of admission to our Saturday Morning Wealth Conference on April 25th if you register by April 20th. Want to give the hotel a nice solid count for those numbers. That's why we do that. So I hope you can meet us then and sign up by April 20th. Get that discount. It's going to be called Global Value Investing, Finding Opportunities in Foreign, Domestic, and Emerging Markets. Sign up on investtalk.com.
Thanks again for subscribing to our podcast. Coming up on the next Invest Talk, when borrowing, you may have more options than you think. The bad and good of debt. That's our talking point for Tuesday, April 14th. We hope you listen to that podcast.
888-99 chart, 888-992-4278. That's how you get through and ask your question on Invest Talk each and every weekday. And we are live 4 to 5 Pacific time, so please try to make your phone calls if you are listening live. We have about 35 minutes left in the show to get your call in, but try to do it sooner rather than later. Now, we're going to talk about our main talking point today, which is hedge funds. Should you invest in hedge funds? Are hedge funds right for you? And most people think of hedge funds, they think, oh, well, hedge funds are a low risk because they're hedging, right? They make money on the downside of the market, right? Well, that can be true, but most times actually not true. Most things will generally feel that hedge funds reduce risk. But the fact is that hedge funds often take higher risks than in the stock market or many other investments. The big question is, should you invest in a hedge fund? And the answer for many and most people is that no, it's probably not right for them, and it's also probably not available for them. Usually, most hedge funds only have account minimums or they have minimums to invest. It's only for qualified investors, meaning people have over $100 million in net assets and basically wealthy people. And so there's high minimums. Usually, it's for institutions as well. They invest in hedge funds. And so only the idea is that higher income investors, institutional investors, they can afford the higher risk. All right. So this initial investment usually that are very high usually limits entry potential. So most people can't. No, the question is, should you invest in these funds of funds, right? There's funds out there where you can put money in and they aggregate a bunch of people's money together and they'll put it into various hedge funds. Well, that is an option, but what you have to realize about hedge fund managers is that in order to be successful, they have to make big bets. They usually use a lot of leverage, and it's kind of a make or break thing. It really is. They leverage up the hedge fund, borrow a lot of money against the investor's assets, right? Have some sort of leverage, kind of like an investment bank, and they invest in securities, whether they're bonds, stocks, whatever it is, they're usually taking a high risk. And the reason they do that is because you have to remember how hedge funds get paid. It's usually 2 in 20, meaning 2% of the net assets, underlying assets that are being managed, and then 20% of the profits. Now, in the era after a lot of hedge funds went bust in 2008, 2009, it's kind of changed a little bit. But that's still generally the fee structure for most hedge funds. And you have to remember, they make a lot of their money off of that 20%. So what happens is they end up taking a lot of risk because they want to make 20, 30, 40% return on that particular hedge fund. Because guess what? They get 20% of it. And that means a lot of money for them and the shareholders. well, them and the partners, right? And so they end up taking a lot of risk. Well, that's great when everything's doing fine, you have a bull market, risk is on, etc. Well, what happens when you hit a recession, you hit a bear market, and risk starts to come off the table? Well, a lot of times their big bets turn sour, and because of that large leverage, because of the high debt or the high risk investments they're putting the money into, they turn sour pretty quickly, and you can lose all the money. So it's usually not a great investment, especially on an individual basis. It's also a limited partner, so the head partner in this legal structure kind of has all the power here, and you have very limited power. So, you know, if you're going to do it, you know, funds of funds might be a good idea, but then that increases fees again. So a lot of people think they're great as an alternative, diversifier, etc. And they may be in a small form, but really they're not the best avenue, even though it sounds great because all these rich people are investing it. Well, they can afford to lose all the money they're putting in because, you know, it might be only a couple million dollars when they have hundreds of millions of dollars, right? So understand who's right for, and for the most part, the average person, not right for them. Now, if you'd like to hear more about hedge funds, just go to investtalk.com, click on the Talking Point link, and we'll talk about it. Your question comes first. We're here for you at 888-99-CHART.
Hello, Steve. Diego from Aventura, Florida. I want to ask you about the Schwab ETF of real estate, SCHH. What do you think? Because I want to play in real estate and I don't pay commission in this one. Do you think it's a good one? And what is your target enterprise? Thanks.
All right, he's looking at SCHH. This is it's a ETF. It's a REIT ETF. They own REITs. This has a very low expense ratio, which is good. So that's a positive. There's very similar to like IYR, kind of the most popular. That's the iShares U.S. Real Estate Index. So pretty similar to that. Like I said, low expense ratio, which is good. The biggest issue right now is interest rates. REITs are very sensitive to interest rates. You saw this back in the taper tantrum. Remember the taper tantrum in 2013? This went from $36.50 a share all the way down to less than $30, so $29 and change. So you're talking about a 20% drop in this particular equity, and you're going to see something very similar, and you have seen that so far this year as the Fed's threatening to raise interest rates. This has been very weak. So the valuations in the REIT sector are overvalued, and so I like it to have on your watch list because it's a good ETF, low expense ratio, etc. But I don't think right now is a good time to be invested in REIT. So I would say good ETF, bad timing. Now you're listening to Invest Talk coming up on the next half hour. A little last minute tax advice. I'm portfolio manager Justin Klein, 888-99-CHART. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. It looks like we're going to Invest Talk Personal, right? Okay. We're going to talk about the day-to-day personal finance choices that can impact your life. And it's not just the mega rich with their offshore bank accounts who might raise red flags to the IRS. The chances are slim that you'll be audited, but staying along the straight and narrow is the best advice to avoid a nasty confrontation with the IRS. So here are some tips to help avoid being audited. Well, first, in our technology age, you have social media, and it can be your friend in certain instances, but it may not be your friend if you're trying to hide something. There's really no reason the IRS can't use social media to see if you're living in one state but claim you live in another for tax purposes, stuff like that. They've been using public records like motor vehicle and employment documentation to confirm if a taxpayer has moved to another state. So, you know, don't think that the IRS isn't above using your social media to prove something that they are trying to look into. Second, don't leave off any income. That's a big, big red flag. The IRS has sophisticated software that enables them to match up all the income that was reported under your Social Security number. That includes 1099s, money you invest, interest, etc. And if they find that you underreported, that gets them more interested in you, and they'll start double-checking everything. So that's important as well. I know I've had that happen before. I think I got a letter from the IRS because I forgot to report $8 in interest income from my savings account, I think it was. Something crazy like that. So don't think you can just skirt a couple dollars because it's so infinitesimal. They see it all, and they're going to want you to report it and pay tax on all of it. So make sure you double-check everything. Now, don't mix business with pleasure. The IRS keeps a close eye on the income and deductions reported by self-employed taxpayers. You need to keep a log. Then there are the deductions for your home office. You're required to have a designated area that is exclusive and often for work. Now, double check. Filing electronically may help catch errors, but experts say taxpayers should pause to make sure they're claiming the appropriate amount of deductions. The IRS could flag your return if the deductions you claim seem out of line for your income bracket. That's important as well. So make sure it makes sense when you're doing the deductions, and if it doesn't, make sure you have a lot of documentation to back it up. Now that's Invest Talk Personal. Do you have personal finance questions you'd like answered? Send me a note. Give us a call. Whatever way you want to get in touch, you can go to investtalk.com, click on the Contact Us, Contact Justin button, or Contact Steve, and we'll go directly to us. Now let's get back to our listener line at 888-99-CHART. Here's a call that came in earlier.
This is Brian Henderson from Tom's Village, New Jersey. I am interested in the ticker symbol SZYM, Solarzyme Incorporated. And I was wondering, as a play on alternative energy and a high growth stock, what your value is and what the future prospects might hold. Thank you very much. Love the show. Bye.
Solarzyme Incorporated. I have never heard of it. SZYM is the symbol. They manufacture oil from low-cost plant sugar feedstocks for fuel and chemicals, nutrition, and personal care markets. So it sounds like they're like an ethanol type of company. Doesn't look like they've ever made money. So that's kind of worrying to me. They provide new renewable oils and other byproducts. What else? Yeah, skin care, personal care, nutrition. So kind of diversified a little bit, but they still never made money. That's kind of worrisome. Now they do have growth, especially lately. The past seven quarters, they've been growing revenue, I would say about a 40% clip on average, 35% to 40%, which is nice growth. And they're supposed to lose the least amount of money since 2010 next year at 65 or 75 cents a share. So they're improving their losses, but they're still losing a lot of money. High debt, still burning cash, negative cash flow, negative profitability. Return on assets are not getting better. Return on assets are only gotten worse, negative 56%. Their margins, net margins, have improved slightly from 2013, but they're still vastly negative. So I don't see anything positive about this. Obviously, they could get up in revenue to where the point where their business is so scalable that they turn a profit. And that's obviously they're starting to get closer to that point, but they're so far from it, and their metrics are still so far from getting to that point, and they have a high debt level. I would probably stay away from it, and technically the chart still looks pretty bearish, even though it's kind of trended up recently, but it's still a penny stock sitting at $3.21 a share, and that's down from a high when it IPO'd in 2011. That was hit its high as $27 a share in the first couple months, and now we're at $3. So killing stockholder equity, I would stay away from it. Now, I hope you'll take this opportunity to give yourself an advantage. Come to our Saturday Morning Wealth Conference coming up on April 25th. You can register now at investtalk.com. It's called Global Value Investing. It's about opportunities outside our domestic sphere. And you'll learn how to value foreign stocks, compare them to domestic stocks, how to manage political and currency risk, how to factor in global economic changes like quantitative easing, globalization, different laws, etc. And you'll learn a lot. You'll learn a lot on how to think about these other markets, because in today's day and age, they're just as important as our own domestic markets. And if you want to join us, you can sign up now on investtalk.com.
A quick reminder, if there's a term that you hear mentioned on the program but you're unclear about what it means or you have a question about it, we want you to ask. It's very likely that you're not the only one with that same question. 888-99-CHART.
888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. Let's talk about the economy. Very important. I talked earlier in the show about how the expected GDP growth for the first quarter is going to be mild. We had about a 2.2% growth in the fourth quarter of last year. That is down from about a 5% growth in the third quarter of last year. And we're going to downshift again in the first quarter of this year to something sub 2%, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 to 1.5%, could be as low as maybe even 0.5%. Some really bearish analysts are expecting, you know, flat to maybe slightly negative GDP growth. But so that's something that you need to look out for. And the big question is this a trend, the beginning of a trend, or is this similar to last year, where in the first quarter we had negative GDP growth, and that was just kind of a one-off thing with the weather, etc., that killed the first quarter, and you have something very similar weather-wise so far in the first quarter of this year, first 2 months of the year. March, not so much, but January and February were. Then you had the port shutdown on the West Coast. That kind of threw a wrench into some things as well. Now, the big question is it a one-off thing, or is it the start of a trend? And some forecasters see weakness as transitory and expect the current quarter to be, like I said, similar to last year. And the estimates for the second quarter are at about 3.1%. And you're going to have some economic news come out this week to shed some light on whether it's going to be a transitory one-off weak quarter or it's going to be a quarter that is the start of something, I guess, more ominous for the economy, something that could put us into a recession, right? So you have some major releases. You have the March retail sales report due tomorrow. That always going to be important. You have headline sales that have fallen 3 months in a row. Now, you have household income growth that has held up well at about 4.5% year on year. And that should lead to some decent growth in consumer consumption as the weather thaws, right? Now, some positives is that was motor vehicle sales. They did pretty well on the back of really strong numbers from trucks because of lower gas prices, et cetera, and those are high-priced, high-margin type of purchases. Now, the consensus, they anticipate a 1% headline retail sales increase and a 0.7% gain excluding autos. So that's tomorrow, and that'll be important to see. Then on Wednesday, we have the New York Empire Manufacturing Survey Index, and you're going to see what's activity like for factories at the start of this quarter. The consensus is for a little change to the index. Now, last month, new orders and shipments declined, which posts a headline risk for the month of April. Now, and then on Wednesday, you also have industrial production, which is projected to decline 0.3% after the cold weather drove February to a net gain on surging utility output. Then you have capacity utilization, which continues to ease lower since November, and that's worth watching because as capacity utilization slows down, it implies that that companies are going to reduce their capital investment needs because their factories aren't working as hard, so they're not having to invest and spend money on replacing equipment and upkeep, etc. Then on Thursday, you have housing starts for the month of March. They're going to be released. And February starts dropped to an annualized rate of about 900,000 from about almost 1.1 million. And analysts are expecting that to rebound a little bit. And then finally on Thursday, the consensus for the Philadelphia FRB Business Outlook Survey anticipates an increase to 5.8 from 5 previously. That'll be interesting to see how businesses are seeing the strong dollar, etc. And but there's some downside risk to that because of the weaker headline from before. And then a Friday morning, you have the March CPI, which is kind of important when it comes to what the Fed's going to do. If it still remains around the 1.7, 1.8 mark, that means that it's still the inflation isn't that bad, and the Fed could push raising rates a little bit longer. If it surprises the upside, maybe that means they're going to push that rate rise going forward. So, and then finally, you have the Michigan Survey of Consumer Sentiment. That will also come out on Friday as well. So a lot of interesting economic news to keep an eye on, and it'll give us a good indication of how transitory the first quarter GDP weakness really was. Now, 888-99-CHART is how to reach us. You can call our 24-hour listener line. And John listens to us in Tribeco Canyon. He has a question for us.
Yeah, I'd like to get your opinion on Freeport-McMoRan, FCX. It's been going up and going down like the yo-yo. I would really appreciate your view on this particular stock.
All right, he's looking at Freeport-McMoRan. They're copper and gold. They're one of the largest copper producers in the world. They have mines all over the world, Indonesia, North, and South America. Earnings fell 61%, are going to fall 61% this year on the back of lower copper and gold prices. And that's to 76 cents a share, down from almost $5 a share they made in 2011 when commodity prices were not at their peak, but really recovering strongly from the financial crisis. This yields about 1.1%. Sales went down 11% last quarter. Debt's 101% debt to equity ratio, kind of high on the debt mark. This is very weak. The big thing for me is I don't think it's quite at the value levels that I would like to see. Now, it's on the cheaper side, but it's not cheap enough for me yet to really get into it. It's a big bellwether. They're a huge company, a $19 billion market cap, and that's after falling from a high of, let's see, what was the high in 2011? 2011, they were at a high about $60 a share, now to $18.26 a share. So back then, you know, their market cap was somewhere in the neighborhood of, let's say, $60 billion or so. Now they're down sub $20 billion. They're trading right at about book value. Yields 1.1%, but they just recently decreased that dividend. So that's not good. But I think in the short term, you know, I think there's some more downside volatility. I'm more bullish on gold than I am copper, especially because what's happening in China and the growth slowdown there. It's weighing on copper, which was very, very inflated because of how much building was going on in China and how much they're hoarding copper, etc. So not the type of name that I would want to be in the short term. It's a good company to have in your watch list, and when things really bottom out for copper, I think you pick it up. But I think this has a chance of getting back into the single digits, which it did dip there back in late 2008, and I think that has the potential of going there again. So something to keep on your watch list, and I would pick it up sub $10, but just not yet. Now we're coming up on the last segment of the program. We have about 10 minutes left in the show, call it 9 minutes left in the show, to get your questions answered. So give us a call. Let's try to get your question to us. Call us now at 888-99-CHART.
Makes a stock fit into a certain category like emerging markets? Or what's your question? Why not ask it now at 888-99-CHART on InvestTalk? Our podcast distribution is made possible each day by KPP Financial. If you're an InvestTalk insider, you have access now to our latest webinar, The Upside of Lower Oil Prices. Sign up for free on InvestTalk.com.
401k millionaires. Now, Fidelity just put out a report, and they talked about the five habits of 401k millionaires. And they tout that many people have become 401k millionaires, meaning that they have over $1 million in their 401k. And they said you don't have to make a lot of money. You don't have to make $150,000 per year. You can make less than that and still become a 401k millionaire. And there's been a lot of news articles about it, how to become a 401k millionaire on CNN, secrets of the 401k millionaires on MarketWatch, how to save $1 million for retirement, USA Today. And I think it's making it sound a little bit easier than it really is. Only about 0.6% of Fidelity's accounts, 401k accounts, have balances of over $1 million, so about half of 1%. And Fidelity found, and there's five attributes, right? And they say start saving early. And they said Fidelity found that on average 401k millionaires had worked for the same company for 34 years. And that's the average. So the question is how likely are you to stay with one particular company for 34 years or longer? So that's really the key to this stuff, because when you leave a job, most of the time it's better to roll that over into an IRA and manage it separately. It's usually a better idea. And not to combine 401ks. So that's what most people do. And so to get a 401k, and you can combine 401ks from different companies when at your current company, right? But most people don't do that. So it's really about longevity at your company. Starting early is also important, but it's really about that longevity of putting money in that 401k each and every payday. That's what's most important. And the big question is, number two, how much do you put in? And you should really contribute minimum of 10 to 15%. And Fidelity notes that the average 401k millionaire has a 14% contribution rate, which is pretty high. We always suggest 10 to 12%. That's, I think, what most people should do. Higher is great. Gets you a much better chance of becoming a 401k millionaire. But I think 10 to 12% is pretty adequate. You know, but the problem is most people don't even get close to that 10% mark. They're usually, you know, 3% or so, maybe sometimes less. So really try to, the national average is 6%, just an FYI. So that's the national average. So 10% is aggressive, 14%, that's very, very high. Number three, meet your employer match. And Fidelity states that 96% of all 401k participants are in a plan that offers some type of employer contribution, meaning some type of employer match. Well, that might be true, but only 58% of companies offer a 401k match. Get that? There's 96% of participants are in a plan that offers one, but only 58% of companies. You're saying, well, how is that? Well, it's because large companies tend to match. They have the money to. They're big, giant companies, they have millions and sometimes billions of dollars, and they need to attract top talent, they want to reward their workers, etc., and they can do that financially, and so they offer that match, whereas half of small companies do not offer that match. So many people might not be an option. Now, many people have that option, the 401k match, and they don't contribute up to the match, which they really should. And then number four, consider mutual funds that invest in stocks. Well, Fidelity 401k millionaires had 75% of their assets in equities. Well, that's great, but and that just leads me to believe that a lot of the reason that there's these 401k millionaires is because of the equity rally. And you got to remember, when you have the next bear market, I guarantee a lot of these 401k millionaires, if they stay invested in equities, they're not going to be 401k millionaires anymore. So just realize that. It's not necessary, I think, that you have all your money in equities. Certainly a nice allocation there is important, but that's big. And then number five, don't cash out when changing jobs. A lot of people do that. A lot of people borrow against their 401k. They cash out the 401k. Not a good idea in the end. Now, before we close the hour, a reminder to sign up for Invest Talk Insider, the Invest Talk Insider program. It is free, and it gives you access to all sorts of information, our latest webinar. The upside of lower oil prices is now available. You can get that by becoming the Invest Talk Insider. I'm Portfolio Manager Justin Klein, and for Steve Peasley and everyone at KPP Financial, thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us again on the next Invest Talk.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.